had to be you.
Is that men and women can't be friends because the sex part always gets in the way.
I wandered around and finally found
the someone who is supportive.
I'm in love with
could
you.
Make me be true.
Snap out of it.
Could make me
that comes
be
out of your eyes and your voice and the way you stand there and the way you walk. You're lit from within, Tracy.
It had to be you, wonderful you. It had to be you.
Hello, romantics. Welcome to It Pod to Be You, the Talk Film Society podcast that's all about falling in love on the big screen. I'm your host, Manish Mathur, and each episode I'll be chatting with a guest about one of their favorite romantic comedies, from classics to modern hits. My guest today is Amrita Rajan. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks. You're my first international guest. Where are you calling from today?
I'm calling from India.
Yeah, very exciting. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And would you like to introduce the film for us today?
Yeah, sure. So as soon as I heard about this podcast and you asked me on, I knew I wanted to talk about like something that was like fun, but also like something a little older. And I thought back to a movie that I loved, which is Pillow Talk, which is a movie starring Doris Day and Rock Hudson. I believe it was the first movie that paired the two of them together, and they had such a ball, and like everybody that saw it thought that they were so amazing together that they went on to become like this very storied pair because their chemistry was just off the charts. It's about this working woman, and this is like a movie that was shot in the late 1950s. So, you know, she's like a working woman and she's successful. And then she meets this playboy on this party line, which is something that I had to look up. I didn't know what that was, but we can talk about that later. But she meets this playboy and she's like super irritated with him. And then he sort of eventually seduces her through underhanded means. And it's all very funny, a tiny bit problematic, but we talk about that too. But it's also like one of those movies that I saw when I was like probably too young to really understand what it was that I was watching. But, you know, it was great. So that's what I'd like to talk about today.
Yeah, no, I'm really, really glad that you picked this movie because, like, it's one that I really loved when I first saw a couple of years ago. I believe I saw it in college, like, when I was studying, like, comedy film in college. And this is, like, one that my professor picked because it was, like, one of the first, like, sex comedies that were coming.
Yeah.
Or at least, like, definitely one of the more risque, like, one of the boldest ones. And so it was like really influential and I really loved it, but I hadn't seen it in a while. I own it on DVD and like I had to like kind of dig through my collection to find it, but I'm really glad that I didn't like donate it or sell it back because it was such a delight to watch. And I'm really glad that you picked it because it's like, it's such a classic and it's such a movie that I think people kind of know about like in the abstract, but maybe haven't seen or haven't seen in a while.
Right.
And I think it's like definitely worth talking about. So do you actually remember the first time you saw it or what,
yeah.
What it means to you now?
Yeah. So I've talked about this before, but like I grew up in Delhi, which is the capital of India. And, and I'm old, so when I was growing up, we didn't have cable TV in India. Like cable TV didn't really come to India until the early to mid 90s, I would say. So what we had instead was basically where I stayed was like a sort of gated community. And in the gated community, we had a video store. And the guy that owned the video store was also sort of like the cable programmer.
and what
he would do is like he'd basically like choose, like he would just program stuff. So like in the morning, like he'd put on like something in Hindi, and then it would be like something like it's like family viewing. And then as the day progressed, like the things would become like more you know, like from cartoons we would go into like something that was for the whole family, and then it would be like a violent action movie. And then at night, I'm pretty sure he used to play porno, but I'm not sure because I had to be in bed by then. But he had, like, this really wide, like, he would just put on whatever came to his hand, I think. I don't think he actually, like, knew what it was that he was playing. I think he was just like, well, what's within reach today? And one of the movies that played was Pillow Talk. And I saw, like, a little bit of it, I think. And I was maybe, like, 10 or 11. And I thought the two of them were so beautiful and so glamorous. And they were so funny together. And I wanted to see more of it. So I went down to the video store and I checked it out. And I saw the whole movie. I think I was, like, way too young to watch this movie because I was watching it back right now and I was just like, oh my God, no wonder I'm, like, so screwed in the head. Like, this is the kind of movies that I was watching when I was a child. But I remember, like, really enjoying this movie because they were, you know, it's definitely a movie that you can watch without understanding, like, the deeper ramifications of what it is that you're watching. It's one of those things that I think, like, they do in Indian cinema as well, where, you know, the movie works in, like, two levels. I think in today's terms, in Hollywood terms, I think it would be like a Pixar movie where you can watch it, like, as a child and you watch an entirely different movie than you watch as an adult. So I definitely saw it as a child through the eyes of a child, and I really enjoyed it. And then I saw it later, much later, as an adult, and I was still, I think I was in my early 20s when I saw it the next time, and I was a little bit, like, and I knew more about who these people were. Like, I had a better sense of who Rock Hudson was and what his life was about and how it sort of related to this movie. And then I was just like, oh. And then I got to see it this time, and I think there's a lot to talk about this movie.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like, you know, the one thing that I really picked up on is just, like, how beautiful this movie is. And, like, I can see how, like, as a kid, you know, someone might just be, like, totally transfixed by it because it's so colorful. Like, the costumes are so glamorous. The sets are, I mean, the sets are, like, amazing. And just, like, the color, like, it's an Eastman color film, which I don't really know quite know what that means, but just like the way that the film is so textured and rich. So like, definitely, like, watching it just feels so just so, like, striking and, like, gorgeous to look at, and it really sticks in your mind, just, like, how, like, the film feels modern for its time, but it doesn't feel too dated now.
So one of the things that, since you're talking about how beautiful things are within and the design and everything, so one of the things that's, like, really interesting to me about this film is that up until then, Doris Day had this very, like, vanilla image. And everybody was just like, oh, it's good girl Doris. And then with this movie, and it was actually selected for her by her husband, who wanted to make her into a bigger star. And she had an entire wardrobe that was, like, specifically designed to make her look more sexy, which she does, you know. So I think, like, the brief was basically, like, a sexy angel, just basically what she
Yeah, I mean, Doris Day definitely looks, I mean, she looks so stunning. And Doris Day is, like, one of those, like, Hollywood figures that it's, like, hard for me to think of her as a, like, sex symbol just because, you know, like, I grew up with her. Like, she's someone that I've always known. And I feel like I knew her more as a singer than an actress. But I feel like it's so jarring to me to, like, think of people, like, watching her films, like, in the 1950s and 60s and being like, oh, wow, she is, like, really hot. But, like, it's just, like, someone that, like, I grew up watching as a kid. Like, I never thought of her that way. But, like, watching the film this time, like, some of her costumes were just so, like, elegantly designed, but so, like, I wouldn't say sexual or, like, sensual. Like, she just looks so, like, womanly and feminine. Like, I remember one dress in particular I really liked was a white gown she wore at the club when she first meets Rock Hudson. To me, that was, like, such a beautiful dress, and it really, like, displayed her, like, sense of her, like, her body, but not in, like, a really gross way, but just in, like, she just looks so feminine and girlish, and she looked really lovely in the film.
So for those of you who haven't seen the movie, the one that Manish is talking about is, it's sort of like a boat neck, and it basically covers her right up until her neck in front. But in the back, it sort of cuts down into this sharp V, so she's basically, it's almost like backless. And it's sort of cut, she has this amazing, like, Amazon-esque, you know, like, hourglass figure. And then she's got that beautiful blonde hair, and she's, her makeup is just on point, and yeah, it's just gorgeous. She's beautiful.
It's so funny. I love talking about costume design, but I don't know anything about fashion. So, like, you're describing all these descriptions, and yeah, like, of course I understand that, but I'm also like, well, I would never describe it that way at all.
I know just enough to describe things without actually understanding anything.
But yeah, and like Rock Hudson, I mean, like, we have to talk about him, because he's so just, like, I mean, he's so charming, and, like, the things he does in this movie are, like, on paper I would be like, wow, what a jerk, but in the movie I'm like, he's kind of cool, and I kind of want to look up to him.
I mean, I've always liked him. I've seen pretty much his entire filmography, I think. Not his entire filmography. There were, like, some things that he was in, like, early on in his career, which are just so boring. But he is, it's very, you know what it is, like, in this movie? Like, I think for me, this is basically, like, the American ideal of male and female in this movie. Like, the two of them. He is so tall and broad-shouldered, and he kind of has that Superman face, you know, like, very clean cut. And she is, like, so feminine and, like, very blonde, but, like, very wholesome, but sexy. It's, like, it's very, I can see people in the 1950s going to the movies and just getting their minds blown by the two of them.
Yeah, especially in a movie that's directly about, you know, like, sex and relationships, and a movie that really takes those things, like, seriously. I mean, like, it's definitely not unspoken. Like, they're definitely specifically referencing, you know, like, the fact that, you know, she's single and doesn't have anyone to sleep with, and that the fact that he's, like, basically, I mean, I believe she calls him a sex maniac at some point. And, like, to me, even now, like, I mean, this movie is almost 60 years old, and I'm like, wow, I can't believe they were saying sex maniac in the 1950s. But this movie really pushed the boundaries on what could and couldn't be shown on screen.
So I don't know if people in the audience remember, like, the Hays Code, which is something that you know about, but it's it's like this moral code that basically spanned the entire golden age of Hollywood. And I think people have heard about it without, like, really understanding what it was about. But they think, like, you know, like, you couldn't show sex on screen. But basically, you couldn't show, like, the appearance of sex even. So, like, that's why, like, everybody slept in, like, separate twin beds, for instance. Which I honestly, as a child, when I used to see those movies on, like, TCM or whatever, I used to actually think, like, oh, that's how people sleep in America. Like, I didn't really understand that. I was, like, the code thing going on. But you couldn't talk about things like, you know, you couldn't do something that was immoral and have a happy ending. And there are lots of, like, really tragic things that have, like, sort of gotten encoded in our popular culture. Like, you know, there's one thing that, you know, a stereotype that you say, like, bury your gays, which is basically, like, a gay person, then you'll always have, like, you always die at the end somehow. So basically, it basically punished people that weren't, like, strictly, like, heterosexual and, like, doing things that were, like, morally upright all the time. And if you're, like, a woman that was, like, working, or if you were gay, or, you know, if you strayed from the whatever they considered to be the straight and narrow, then basically you had to be punished on film. And that sort of, like, informed popular culture in the United States, and through Hollywood movies, I think it affected, like, a lot of other cinemas, including that of India in certain ways for a long time. And in the 1950s is when they really started pushing against the boundaries of this in American film. And like your professor told you, like, this was like one of the first real sex comedies that came out, and it was like a huge success, and people really liked it. And I think by like 1965, so basically like 5 or 6 years after this movie came out, the code was finally struck down, and they basically moved to the rating system, which is what we have today in Hollywood. So this is like a hugely influential movie, and I just want to put that on record, because I know we will talk about how problematic this is, because there's things in this film where you're just like, oh my God, did that really happen? But I think for its time and place, it is hugely influential, and it did have an important role to play.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that this movie is a big hit, because it kind of shows that the audience's sensibilities were changing, or they were at least more, they were more comfortable in, you know, voting with their wallet. Because essentially, I feel like the Hays Code had to be struck down, because like movies like this and other films like Sex and the Single Girl, The Moon is Blue, like these kind of basically, these like very risque comedies were being made, and they were very popular. And I think eventually just realized there's no money in movies that were like strictly adhering to the Hays Code. But what I also think is interesting is that movies like Pillow Talk, and Doris Day in particular, she had a very strong box office run. I mean, she was like the top star for a number of years, but eventually even like movies like Pillow Talk and like her other films with Do Not Disturb,
Lover Come Back,
yeah, Move Over Darling, even those started to lose fashion. Because they were now seen as too tame, even if they were very progressive just 5 years before. So it's interesting how like Doris Day had this really like strong period where she was like pushing the envelope forward, and then almost immediately she became somewhat passé towards like the late 1960s.
I mean, this movie came out in 1959, and then, you know, 10 years on, it's 1969.
Yeah.
And the whole culture changed.
Yeah, yeah. But so, I mean, let's get into the film. I want to talk about this party line, because I had never even heard of it, and it's it's such a strange concept to me now. Because I remember like researching it when I first saw the movie, and it just seemed so alien. But do they have those in India? I mean, I guess they were out of fashion by the 1970s or 80s, maybe, here in America, I think.
I've never heard of these things. Like, like as a child, I couldn't understand why she was sharing this phone line with another person. Like, I honestly thought they just invented that thing for the movie. Like, you know, it's just like a convenient plot point. But I guess it was a real thing for a while.
But it's a great device, though, because it allows for these, like, really funny split screens. That, you know, basically, like, there was, I was reading online that, like, this movie couldn't show the two of them in bed together or in a bath together, but because of the party line and because of the split screens, you could have the, like, thrill of seeing, Doris Day and Mark Hudson in bed together, and you could see them, like, sharing a bath. So it allowed for these, like, very, like, risque images that could, like, skirt around, like, the Hays Code, because they're technically not together physically, but it just looks like they are. So I really like that a lot.
And big note to, like, you know, whoever might be watching this movie, Rock Hudson did not skip leg day, by the way.
Oh, my God, yeah. Like, that scene in the bath, I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah. Right? He's just perfect.
Yeah, he and Paul Newman and Robert Redford are, like, the three main guys who are just, like, objectively, like, whatever your orientation is, they're just, like, beautiful, beautiful people.
Yeah, they basically look like they're photoshopped. It's like how perfect they are.
Yeah, right, exactly. I guess we can kind of dive into, like, how this movie is problematic. Because, like, it does tap into a lot of romantic comedy, like, cliches that are still done today, which now are, like, almost unforgivable for some people. So, like, what are your thoughts on kind of the hook of him having to, like, put on a different persona to, like, woo her?
Okay, so in the movie, what happens is that the way he's sort of like annoyed by her, but then he sees her in person and she doesn't know who he is. So he decides that he's just going to lie to her basically and sort of invent this persona of a shy Texan who's in town, the big city, which is New York. And he sort of, okay, the way they meet is also like one of the thing that just made my skin crawl. And I didn't remember the scene at all. Like, I've seen this movie like a couple of times before. I did not remember this part where she basically is at this club because it's the only way, like agreeing to come to this club with this, this young man who like hilariously is like described as like a Harvard man, and this, that's it. And it's like less funny in the era of like Brett Kavanaugh, I guess. Right. But basically he's exactly who you would think. He's like this young, like preppy who is super entitled and handsy, and he keeps trying to assault her in a car, and he's drunk and he's like driving too fast. And she basically says, fine, like I'll come with you to this club for like 5 minutes if you'll stop pawing at me. Right. And so they end up at this club. That's where Rock Hudson meets her for the first time, and she doesn't know that it's him, but he understands immediately that this is the annoying woman on the other side, on the other end of his party line, and he decides to basically lie to her and invent this persona. And then they basically start dating. So it's her, and she thinks that he's wonderful because he came to her rescue, and he's basically just lying to her all the time. And it's a trope that we'll see again in like a bunch of rom-coms, as you said, you know, like the guy or the girl who like invents this persona and basically catfishes the other person.
It's usually a guy. I can't really recall any examples of when it's the woman doing it. I'm sure they're there. I just can't. But it's most likely going to be the male character.
I just wanted to leave the field open because I'm sure there'll be like one person who's like, not all men.
Yeah, well, whatever.
I mean, at the end of the movie, he basically says, you know, like he felt very guilty, blah, blah, blah. But he fully intended to sleep with her, and he knew exactly. And the whole thing was put into motion, and he like explicitly thinks to himself that, you know, that this is like a really good way to like get her into bed. And it's played for laughs, and you do laugh at like certain things, you know, like the... You kind of see like him like calling her up and like suggesting these things, and then which gives him an opportunity to basically, be better than her expectations of him, I guess. And you can see how clever the script is while also acknowledging that, you know, it's pretty shitty.
Hello?
Miss Morrow, Brad Allen.
Look, I am in a hurry, Mr. Allen, so if you don't mind.
Of course. But before you hang up, just admit I was right.
About what?
Your Western gentleman. He turned out to be a prairie wolf, didn't he?
Mr. Allen, this may come as a shock to you, but there are some men who don't end every sentence with a proposition.
Oh, come on. You mean he didn't try to get you up to his hotel room?
Yes, he took me to his hotel room.
Uh-huh.
He showed me Central Park, and then we left.
And nothing else?
Nothing.
That's even worse than I thought.
Worse? What do you mean worse?
Well, must I spell it out? Either you're not telling the truth or...
Or what?
Well, there are some men who just... they're very devoted to their mothers. You know, the type that likes to collect cooking recipes or exchange bits of gossip.
Ooh, what a vicious thing to say.
Oh, I hope I'm wrong, but don't you think you better make sure?
You are sick!
What's funny to me about this whole situation is how he can, subtly suggest to her, like, when he's, like, actually Brad, like, on the phone with her, after the dates, and he kind of suggests to her that, oh, like, this guy, like, he seems too good to be true, and that he might be, like, in the closet, and or, like, home, like, because he'll suggest, like, oh, like, if he's, like, too much into cooking, or, like, too much, like, affectionate towards his mom, and then, like, on the next date, like, as the Texan, he'll, like, make references to cooking and stuff. So it's, like, that kind of thing, I think, is, like, funny, and kind of puts her on edge, because she's then questioning, like, her own attractiveness in a way, which is also kind of, also very problematic, but also, I don't know, I think this movie is, like, it's one of those movies where I find it hard to just, like, write, like, dismiss as problematic, even though it very much is, just because it's so, like, fluffy, you know? Yeah. It's, like, harmless, and, like, I think that, but I also don't want to be, like, the guy who's, like, whatever, it's not problematic, because, I mean, it is, but it's also, like, I don't know, it's 60 years old, like, it's just... And, like, it's just, like, hard... It's hard for me just to, like, write it off, because, like, the things that were happening in this movie were so unique at the time. And, like, it didn't become, like, a tired cliche until, you know, like, much, much later. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It's, like, it's a weird balance this movie has. I think it's, like, it's so charming and, like, cute and funny and sweet, but it's also, like, yeah, there's this, like, other, like, darker side to it that, like, the movie really doesn't want you to think about it too much.
Yeah. I think what you're responding to and what I share as well is the response to good writing.
Yeah.
Like, the... I mean, everything about this movie, you know, and it's also the chemistry between the leads. So it's... A, it was, like, the first of its kind. Secondly, it's an amazingly good script. The banter between the two and, like, the way it's shot and the pacing of it is just perfect. Yeah. And it's also being played by, like, two people who are absolutely on top of their game when they're, like, responding to each other and who are just absolutely in sync.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of all these things. And I think we see and what we react to more strongly and what we see more strongly as problematic in, like, other movies is because they are lesser.
Yeah.
They don't have the same level of performance. They don't have the same level of chemistry or writing or direction. And that's what lets you actually see the flaws and the, you know, the basically gives you, like, a little more of a peek behind the curtain, whereas here, like, everything is, like, this perfect stage show, and it's just overwhelming.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, to the film's credit, like, she does, like, once she kind of puts together, like, this, you know, that he's lying to her, and she does that because she finds, like, sheet music to the song that he sings to all of his, you know, girlfriends, and she realizes that he's the one that has been hogging her phone and the one that's the sex maniac. And I think, I mean, to her credit, she does kind of get revenge on him by, like, redecorating his apartment in this, like, garish, although I thought it was kind of cool looking, but this very, like, outlandish design and, like, really ugly furniture and stuff. So, I mean, in some ways, like, she, you know, she may have been, like, fooled the whole movie, but at least she gets some of it back.
Yeah. And she's, you know, it's almost immediately ruined because then, you know, he's just like, oh, I was thinking of, like, asking her to be my wife. And then she's just like, wife? Yeah. Everything, everything that went before is immediately, right. Erased.
I mean, she uses his own trick apartment against him by, like, locking the door and turning off all the lights, which we have to talk about this apartment because it's so creepy.
God. It's like, it's almost like, you know, I mean, again, like, this is what I mean by the writing is, like, really good because it's, like, obvious, like, he's such an idiot. Like, A, he has, like, the most obvious, like, you know, Playboy apartment.
Yeah.
Wait, do you want to describe it? Because it's amazing.
Well, okay, hey, let me see if I can get all the details right. There's a sofa that becomes a bed.
And when he says bed, he means, like, literally, like, oh, bed.
There's another switch that turns the music on immediately.
Yeah.
There's a switch that locks the door from the inside, which to me is like the creepiest part.
I know.
And then there's another switch that I think turns the lights off. But what, okay, here's my question that I don't know if you have an answer to it, but like, I mean, this, the idea of this apartment must have come from somewhere, and I want to know if, like, there were actually apartments like this back in the day, or if this was just, like, a product of their imagination.
Well, you know what? Do you remember when, oh, God, what's his creep face? What's his face? The guy that got fired off Good Morning America.
Oh, Matt Lauer?
Yes. And Matt Lauer got fired. Like, one of the things that the women that actually complained against him said was, like, he had a button under his desk that allowed him to, like, remotely lock his door from his desk.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I feel like this is the kind of thing that's, like, absolutely, like, within somebody's imagination. Like, I can only imagine, like, somebody's, like, sexual assault den in Hollywood that had something like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, yeah, I mean, that's a great connection because I hadn't even thought of that. I mean, I guess, like, on some level, I always knew that, like, this apartment could and probably would have been used for assault. But I think the implication, I think, that the film is trying to project, which is, it's, I think, successful at to some degree, is that it's that this, like, his sort of maneuvers into seducing women is okay because they're always willing, and that Doris Day is the only one who isn't until she is. And he doesn't use any of those tricks on her. I mean, he does trick her, but he does in some way, like, treat her somewhat differently, I guess, in that, like, he's actually going and putting on this act and taking her out rather than just, you know, bringing women back to his apartment. So I think, I mean, I guess, like, going back to, like, the her, like, you know, attacker, the Harvard man, like, I think the movie is in some ways drawing a separation between them in that, like, you know, he doesn't have to resort to that because he's so, you know, charming and lovable that, like, everyone just is willing to, like, fall for him. I mean, even her housekeeper, played by Thelma Ritter, is, like, enraptured by him.
And also, like, she develops a dislike for him after listening to him on the phone.
Yeah.
It's like she never, like, actually sees him. When she actually does see him, like, her first impression of him is just, like, this pretty much the same as, like, all the other women that meet him, because they're all just like, oh my God, he is a god amongst men.
Yeah.
But also, like, I didn't put two and two together until, like, you spelled it out. But, like, I was thinking about what you just said about, like, him not needing to do any of this, which just makes it even more reprehensible that he just lies to all these women because he likes it.
Yeah.
That's awful.
But I also wonder if, like, the mores of the time would have to, like, force these women to put up some kind of act of not be, like, like, I guess, like, you know, he might feel, and, like, I mean, this is going to sound so icky of me, so please cancel me if this is gross for me to say, but I'm just putting myself in the mindset of, like, you know, a wealthy white man in the 1950s. I imagine, like, he would feel like, If he puts on the act of, like, being just a little bit more, I don't want to say forceful, but, like, forthright, I guess, then maybe that would put them at ease to say yes when, like, they feel like they might have to say no because of the era, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying. Like, it's the pressure to be the good girl.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is basically what the, I think, like, the Harvard boy that, like, tries to assault her is basically, you know, like, when he refuses to take no for an answer, like, I think, like, that's pretty much that whole, like, cultural thing, which is, like, of course, it's like super harmful to like gender relations and to women in particular for decades. But I do see like, you know, this movie being written as men. Like, I do see like how men would feel. Oh yeah, like that would totally be the thing where like she, you know, she wants him, but she can't say that she wants him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's still very gross and icky, but I would imagine that like watching it at the time, you're just so in awe of like how like clever and like smart the film is that like you probably, just like how like I was when I first saw it, and like even like now, like it wasn't until I was reading about the film that I really kind of put together how like creepy this movie is, because like when you're watching it, it's so like it's so well crafted that like you don't really notice it until after you watch it.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Toni Randall and Thelma Ritter. We have the two kind of main supporting characters. So like Toni Randall, I feel like this poor guy is always in this role of being like kind of like the nebbish, like neurotic sidekick, because he pretty much plays the same role. I believe he's in Lover Come Back as well.
Yeah.
He's so funny in this movie, and talking about like going back to like talking about like this kind of like problematic part of it, like he is continually asking her out in like a professional setting, and although he does like it's funny because like he doesn't take no for an answer, but also like he seems somewhat respectful of the fact that like he doesn't try to like force her in any way. He just is always asking her. I mean, he does give her like weird gifts like a car, but
if you want to be creepy to me, then I wish people would be like creepy to me by giving me like a convertible. That's totally the kind of creepiness that I would welcome into my life.
He's also the like connective tissue between them. Like, I don't like Brock Hudson doesn't really. He puts together that like his party line person is Doris Day because of. Of Toni Randall, right? I think.
Yeah.
It's like that connection. But I think he's so funny in this movie though. He's so neurotic and like childish, I guess.
Yeah, he does this thing where like, you know, he's playing a jerk, but he's not a jerk in a way that makes you hate him.
Yeah.
Which is like the Toni Randall specialty, I think. You know, he just knows that exact note to play.
So the one part of the movie that I feel like doesn't play as well as it could have is like this Thelma Ritter subplot with her as like this alcoholic housekeeper.
Yeah.
I just felt like the movie's kind of saying like she's drinking too much because she's single to be single. I really didn't understand like what the point. I wonder
if that was like some sort of like case code weirdness, because I feel like, so there's this whole thing about Thelma Ritter being her alcoholic maid, and when I say alcoholic, I mean like this is a woman that like she like Rock Hudson takes her out for a drink to like pump information out of her, and she basically like drinks him under the table like nobody's business. It's one of the funniest scenes.
That part was great.
But she's, like, the really great character. Like, you know, she's, like, ornery. Like, you know, like, one of those very few characters are, like, ornery. And, like, I really like that about her. But then they seem to feel a need to sort of, like, give her, like, that ending where, you know, the big forceful man is just, like, you need somebody to take care of. And then she's just, like, why? So friendly. So romantic. And then you're just like, oh, you're not that character though. Like, that's not what you're about. But I guess like she couldn't just be like an alcoholic woman who just likes to look like other people's sex lives. So
I mean, like, I have to admit that like the shots of her like slumped over like on the ground in the elevator are pretty funny. she's a great actress. She's so funny in these kind of like wisecracking, you know, sidekick roles. But yeah, it was just a weird ending for that. I was like, that's not really a conclusion I like needed in the film. Before we wrap up, I just wanted to like talk about like Rock Hudson. He was like the first major celebrity to like openly die of AIDS, and like he kind of posthumously became like kind of a queer icon. And like, talk with this film, with it's sort of like, it's sort of like discussing like how, like, you know, being like into feminine things is like coded as homosexual. This is like an interesting artifact of his like career, because he was, I believe, like in his like intimate social circles, he was out, but like not publicly. Like, I'm sure like Doris Day was one of the people that he knew that he was like out, and like, I believe he had like a partner later in life that was sort of like a hush, like an open secret. But I think like with this movie, kind of dabbling in that theme of like, you know, is like the Texan guy that he's playing like supposed to be gay and stuff? Like, it's just an interesting like note in his career, and how like that relates to like queer cinema.
It's just really sad that he died so young and like in such a horrible way. Yeah. Because I mean, you think about, like, you know, it's been what, like 40 years?
Yeah.
Since he passed. And in those 40 years, you know, like, so much has changed. Like, the world has absolutely changed. And imagine, like, somebody like him, if he were alive today and he could, like, tell you, like, what that experience was like as a gay man in 1959, you know, playing this tongue-in-cheek gay character on film while being in the closet, and sort of portraying every woman's heterosexual fantasy.
Yeah.
Like, it's a really complex and really really like heartbreaking sort of like history that we have on, like, captured on film in this movie. And I would have really enjoyed, or I would have really not enjoyed, I don't think I would have enjoyed it, but I would have appreciated getting his perspective on it. And now we'll never know, you know, like, we can have people adjacent to him tell us like how it might have been for him, but we'll never get it in his words, like, you know, what his experience was like.
Yeah. I mean, I think it, in some ways it's, I mean, it's kind of a groundbreaking thing for, you know, to think about, because, like, with him being this, like you say, like, heterosexual woman's fantasy, like, by portraying someone who's so, like, masculine and self-assured and confident, but to be homosexual in secret, like, it's, I mean, in some ways, like, it contradicts like the the very things that this film is saying about, you know, like, you know, femininity in men being like coded for homosexuality, because it's like Rock Hudson in his own personal life could achieve that balance, could achieve like the balance of being like a very masculine guy while also like having somewhat transgressive for the time like romantic life.
But it's also, like, really funny to me, like, the things that they single out as being, like, gay, which is, like, being, like, loving your mom, or, like, likes to cook.
Those are very, like, stereotypical things. I think this movie is really poking fun at, you know, this sort of standards of masculinity and how, like, ridiculous it all is. I think this movie is just so fascinating to talk about. Do you have any like final thoughts on the film or anything else you wanted to bring up?
Just that, you know, like, in spite of like all its flaws and in spite of like how problematic is that it might play to the modern year, I think it's a movie that everyone ought to see at least once, just to like appreciate a certain kind of filmmaking that doesn't exist anymore. And just to see like two people who are on top of their game and like just how wonderfully they play off each other. Like, Doris and Rock Hudson are just amazing in this film.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. Like, this movie, I think, is just so like well-crafted. It's so funny. It's like romantic. Like you said, these two actors are just so like magnificent together. And, like, I think the problematic parts of it are worth talking about, but I don't think they completely destroy the movie. I think the movie is successful enough, like, on as just, like, a pop entertainment. And I think that, like, it's so just, like, it's just lovely. It's a lovely movie. Like, it's, romantic, it's goofy. Like, it's, if you could place yourself in the era of the late 1950s, it's pretty like progressive and fascinating in that way. So, and yeah, I mean, I definitely enjoy rewatching it. I mean, thanks again for, you know, mentioning it.
Yay!
Yeah. So where can people find you online?
Okay, so you can find me on Twitter at AmritaIQ, or you can also find me on my other podcast, which is about Bollywood film, and it's called Khandan. Manish has been on it.
Oh yeah, I was on it back in January, I believe. Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I
really like to talk about Bollywood films, and you guys are so funny. It's a great podcast, and I recommend it if you're interested in Bollywood films at all. Or even if you're not, they're just fun to listen to.
So yeah, just check it out if you feel like checking out something about Indian film.
Yeah, and you can find me on Twitter at the Manish 89. That's THEMANISH89. Also, I don't promote the Twitter of my podcast, but also it Pod2View is on Twitter. So follow us there. Amrita, thank you so much for joining me today. I had such a great time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed being here.
And to the listener, thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you next time. Bye. Another night of hearing myself talk, 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 talk. Wonder how it would be to have someone to pillow talk with me. Being alone with pillow talk. When it's all said and done, two heads together can be better than one.